Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. American patriotism has been a favorite topic of historians for decades, and it is widely acknowledged by observers from all corners of the globe that patriotism is arguably more pronounced in the United States than in any other country on Earth. Why is that the case? And why is it usually taken for granted as if it were something quite natural? What better time to examine the history of the central idea in the American psyche with historian Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary, author of To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On December 19, 1777, General George Washington led his Continental Army to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where they camped for a period of 6 months. It marked the ultimate triumph of morale and military discipline over hardship in the American War for Independence. Following the American military failures at Brandywine and Germantown, Washington led 11,000 demoralized regulars to take up winter quarters at Valley Forge. Whether the Continental Army's means to fight a war against a first-class Imperial British Army were adequate was very much in question. Suffering from the bitter cold of an unusually harsh winter, a lack of clothing, semi-starvation, rampant disease, desertion, and gross mismanagement, Washington's army was a ragtag force found wanting of discipline, morale, and efficiency. General Washington nevertheless held together his dwindling army through the force of his leadership, and the Continental Army that arrived at Valley Forge emerged 6 months later, a well-disciplined fighting force. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, nearly 400 years after crossing the Atlantic, bound for Plymouth Rock in 1620, the Mayflower, or rather a replica of it, may sail the Atlantic once again. A new project to build a full-sized, seaworthy replica of the Mayflower was unveiled by Mike Leese and Chris Parsonage, residents of Plymouth, England, who hope the project will draw tourists to the city, the very port where the Mayflower began her journey carrying the pilgrims to the New World. The replica, which is expected to take about 2 years to build, will be based permanently in Plymouth, England, and the ship's designers plan to consult the architects of another replica, the Mayflower II, that now rests off Plymouth, Massachusetts. The first Jewish synagogue built in the former East Germany since World War II has opened its doors to worshippers in Dresden, more than 60 years after the original synagogue was razed to the ground by Nazi sympathizer during Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass of November 9, 1938. Seen as a concrete expression of the Jews' desire to remain in Germany, the rebuilt synagogue also represents the ongoing reconstruction of Dresden, one of the city's worst hit by Allied bombing in World War II. The original Star of David, salvaged from the flames of 60 years ago, rests above the entrance to the new synagogue. This is Talking History. In response to the events of September 11th, the United States appears to be launched into a new age of patriotism, of flag-waving, singing America the Beautiful, and returning the Pledge of Allegiance to the schools. Without doubt, such patriotism has helped the nation weather the tragedies of that fateful day and to renew our spirits, but it's also raised questions among many as to who gets to claim the American flag and who is to determine the meanings of the republic for which it stands. These questions are not new to historians. In fact, they're central to a newly published book whose author is with us this week. The book is To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, and the author is Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary. Cecilia is a professor of history at the California State University at Monterey Bay, where she also is co-director of the Oral History and Community Memory Institute. Welcome, Cecilia.
Thank you.
Patriotism, always an interesting topic in the United States. But did you have any idea when you started this book how relevant it would be?
I actually didn't know it would become this relevant. I wrote it at a time, it was published 2 years ago, of relative peace. And so when the September 11th attack occurred, I was taken by surprise in terms of how quickly I had to become a public historian. I had to become a public intellectual and really share what I had learned with media around the country, because what I found out when I began this study was that, in fact, there's been struggles over the meaning of patriotism and the meaning of the flag through every single generation in the history of this country.
Well, that's what we're here for today, to give a little historical perspective on it. So let's start with the question. Let me quote to you from what you wrote, that although the Civil War determined the survival of the United States, what it meant to be a loyal American or disloyal un-American remained an open question until the matter was settled, albeit temporarily, during World War I. Explain that sentence for us, if you would.
At the beginning of the Civil War, the United States was principally fighting against the attack by the Confederate States to keep one country. So what patriotism meant was that to die for your country. But then in 1863, when President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he radically expanded the meaning of what the flag represented and what it meant to be a loyal American. Not only did it mean love of country or willingness to die, but he expanded it to include the reciprocal responsibility of the government, of the nation, to ensure that the principles of equality were actually something that were protected and realized in everyday life. So freedom was offered to the slaves. And this really began an emancipatory tradition in the meaning of patriotism in our country. And so when the Civil War ended, of course, the boundaries of the United States had been secured, but what it would mean to be an American, what tradition, would white supremacy reemerge, would this new emancipatory tradition of struggling for actually realizing equal rights and equality, liberty in our everyday lives, would that be something that would come to bear? Would the Confederacy challenge on the cultural front the United States? So there were many, many open questions at the end of the Civil War. And really the battle over what it meant to be American moved off of the field and into the cultural arena.
And how were those questions ultimately answered?
Those questions have never been ultimately answered. Every single generation has had to redefine what it meant to be an American. Between the Civil War and World War I, there was tremendous fluidity and debate and discussion. There were some, such as veterans in the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the first mass organization of veterans, that really promoted the flying of the flag over the public schools and made school children the central activists in patriotic culture. There were others such as the Daughter of the American Revolution who really wanted to have blood and heredity be what determined what it was to be an American. There were progressive educators who, again, wanted to teach patriotism, but they weren't just interested in an emotional attachment to the country, but they wanted to introduce civics and what they would call a thoughtful patriotism, and a patriotism that I would see coming out of the emancipatory tradition that really stresses critical thinking. But by World War I, what happened was for the very first time the U.S. government actually joined forces with what became vigilante groups to enforce a very restrictive, very politically intolerant form of patriotism that meant that other points of view were silenced at the end of that war. And that doesn't mean that they were silenced forever, because as we know in the history of our different wars, the debate has always emerged in terms of whether civil liberties are going to be protected or abandoned, whether citizenship rights are going to be expanded or limited.
Perhaps given the time in which we now live, you could expand a bit on how exactly that happened during World War I.
Well, during World War I, at the very beginning, there was great opposition to the war. There were organizations such as the Socialist Party that saw it really as a war among elites over the spoils of profits and didn't see why workers should have to go and fight in a war that wasn't going to be in their interest. There were organizations such as the International Workers of the World, that really question whether workers should pledge loyalty to a flag that doesn't pledge loyalty to them. African Americans were very much in debate about whether to support the war. Of course, when the war is declared, they closed ranks and absolutely became strong supporters of the war. But before war was declared, there was a real struggle over what does it mean to fight for a country where the citizenship rights had just been lost in the South at the end of Reconstruction. So should there be a bargain that was set? And in the end, they decided, no, we're going to march in step. But this struggle over patriotism and the meaning of Americanism was also further complicated by notions of what is it of race and 100% Americanism. And there were nativists who wanted to close and barricade the borders. They were what I call them is they were not optimistic Americanizers. They didn't believe that immigrants really had contributions to make to the country. They wanted if immigrants to stay out or if they were allowed in, the 100% Americanism was really a view that they would have to become Anglo-Americans. They would have to only speak English, only have identification with an English heritage in terms of the of a nation that they would identify with. And so when German Americans were torn about whether or not they were going to swear allegiance to the flag and give up also a loyalty to Germany, many immigrants had dual allegiances. They weren't disloyal citizens. They just felt torn. They would fly a flag, and some of them would to prove that they were loyal. Others didn't want to fly a flag. Others would be surrounded by mobs on the street and forced to kiss the flag on the ground to prove their patriotism. So the flag really became a litmus test. So it wasn't any act of disloyalty. You had to be actively proving constantly that you were loyal. And in one instance, a man refused to kiss an American flag, and he used the language of, it's just a piece of cloth with painted stripes on it, and it might, you know, have bacteria. For that, he was sentenced to 20 years in the state penitentiary. And the appeal court was not able to reverse that conviction, even though he felt that the crowd who had surrounded this man, the judge said that they had really shown themselves to be like the horrors of the Salem witch trials. He couldn't reverse it because of the Alien and Sedition Acts that had been passed during World War I that made even language that was disrespectful to the flag a basis for conviction.
So symbols like the flag become very important to this process, and rituals, to be sure. Are there any others, for example, the Pledge of Allegiance that you address in your book that you, perhaps you could talk a bit about here?
Well, the Pledge of Allegiance grew out of the schoolhouse flag movement. At the end of the 19th century, the public school system was just beginning to expand and become a national system. And at that very same time, there were different groups of people who wanted to promote patriotism. In fact, the end of the 19th century was really called the Age of Patriotism. It's when the flag, when groups of people organized to make the flag sacred, when there's tremendous organizing and mobilizing to fly the flag over the schools, because people are concerned that without a war like the Civil War, that what's going to teach the new generation loyalty. And so as part of this campaign, a major national magazine that was sold to parents and to teachers called the Youth Companion, they asked one of their workers, Francis Bellamy, to write a Pledge of Allegiance. Francis Bellamy is a very interesting person. He had been a minister. He had been fired by his church because he was found to have views on labor that were much too radical. He preached that Jesus was the friend of the worker. And so he came into working for the Youth Companion as a Christian socialist, as someone who believed in capitalism but was absolutely against the kind of exploitation that he saw taking place with the incorporation of America that was also happening at the 19th century and the immiseration of workers who were working under incredibly harsh conditions. And so when he was asked to write the pledge, He wanted to write something that had historical meaning. Indivisible really echoed the speeches and discussions that had surrounded the Civil War, that it's one nation indivisible. But then he said, well, what does our nation stand for? And this is when he began to entertain, and I found this in his diaries when I was researching archives in Upper State New York. In his diary, he writes, you know, what should we be? What do we represent? And he said, well, maybe I could say in the pledge, I'll use the French slogan from the Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity. This is a very extraordinary idea to think about using a revolutionary slogan that includes equality during the very years that lynching of African Americans was on the rise, that Reconstruction had ended in the South. I mean, this is in 1891, and so he's considering, you know, can I say this in fraternity that we really are brothers and, he would not say sisters, but I would say brothers and sisters in the defense of equality and liberty. But then he thought, no, I think maybe we're too individualistic right now for people to accept that, so I'm going to leave it open so that the nation in the future can decide whether it's going to be an individualistic or socialist state.
Well, interesting. And those same questions really remain with us today. So let me, in the few minutes we have left, move up and just simply ask you, what do you, as an historian, make of this sudden outburst of American patriotism we're seeing today?
Well, first of all, I think it's in direct response to the fact that the attack took place on the mainland of the United States. This is only the second time that the mainland of the United States has been attacked. The first time was in the War of 1812 when the British marched into the capital to burn it down. Pearl Harbor took place, of course, in Hawaii, which isn't on the mainland. So one, we have that the actual earth of the mainland of the United States was attacked. Second, I think that coming off of the dot-com economy of the last two decades, where being American was primarily defined by what you can buy, I think there was a very deep sense among people who flew the flag that they wanted to reclaim a sense of community. And people flew it for many different reasons. I think among them, some just wanted, you know, my country right or wrong, America first, you know, military response. Others were flying it because they felt that a deep tragedy had taken place and they wanted to extend their sense of oneness with the people who had lost their lives. I think other people were flying it for the first time and not sure why to fly it, but wanted to show that we were united as a people. And I think that there's tremendous importance to the different reasons why people fly the flag. And today we really need to consider, which tradition do we want that flag to stand for? Do we want it to stand for an emancipatory tradition, which certainly I do, where we say this United States isn't right or wrong, it's right, and that we're committed to democratic rights inside of the United States and also in terms of who we make alliances with and how this war on terrorism is conducted. Is it going to just be owned by commerce? Is it the United Corporations of America? Flag, and is the flag simply going to become a shopping bag, which I see posters of all over San Francisco? So there's an enormous question right now in terms of, yes, there's been this incredible outpouring of patriotism, but we have to define what that means. We have to say it's not freedom in the abstract. Is it really a dedication to freedom in reality? Like when the bailout to the airlines happened, this was a patriotic act. But meanwhile, the airlines were continuing, United, their parent company, was continuing to buy planes for special business chartered flights. And none of the money was going to the workers who were laid off. So is that the kind of patriotism? When Barbara Lee stood up and said, no, the full war power shouldn't be given to the president, I stand by the Constitution, she got hate mail accusing her of being a traitor. I think Barbara Lee was being a patriot. She was saying democracy is what makes us strong. We need to safeguard that. So we have a enormous challenge in front of us today of how are we going to define the flag, who gets to claim it, and whether or not it's going to extend or limit citizenship rights.
Well, I can't think of a better way to summarize it, so I think we'll just stop right there, and let me thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary, author of To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. And this is Talking History. Terrorism has become one of the most commonly used words in our daily conversation. We use it constantly to describe the events of September 11th. But what does it mean? Does it mean the same thing today as in the past? Or are we looking at a new species of terrorism? That is the subject of this week's op-ed by David Greenberg, professor of history at Columbia University.
As the nation begins its war on terrorism, it's surprising that our leaders haven't yet defined what terrorism is or where it comes from. It's important that we do so. For the reason we've gone to war is that the attacks of September 11th represent a terrorism that's new and more threatening than any kind we've seen before. Not all political violence amounts to terrorism. Terrorism is committed specifically by stateless organizations against established powers. It doesn't attack military or government centers in order to seize power the way guerrilla warfare does. Rather, it targets random, unsuspecting victims in order to publicize a grievance and sow panic. The word terrorism comes from the French Revolution's Reign of Terror of 1793 and 94, when Robespierre and the Jacobins guillotined 12,000 people they deemed enemies of the revolution. In the 19th century, terrorism took the form of anarchism. From the assassination of Russia's Tsar Alexander II to the murder of America's President William McKinley, anarchists tried to bring about a revolution against industrial capitalism. The next stage of terrorism came in the mid-20th century, when peoples around the globe rebelled against colonial regimes. Of these groups, it was Algeria's Front de Libération Nationale that defined modern terrorism. The FLN deliberately spilled the blood of French civilians to raise the price of colonialism to intolerable levels. They bombed beachside cafes where they knew families would be visiting. Ultimately, they succeeded in driving out the French. Their success inspired others, from Ireland's IRA to Italy's Red Brigades to Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization. It doesn't have to cast doubt on Arafat's recent efforts at peacemaking to recall that for years the PLO committed some of the world's most evil deeds. The murders at the Munich Olympics in 1972 and aboard the Achille Lauro cruise ship in 1986 are just two unforgettable examples. The PLO's goals were political, not religious. Arafat eventually realized that if you live by the car bomb, you die by the car bomb. In other words, terrorism could alienate the very people whose respect he was seeking. And so he had to distance himself from terror to gain legitimacy. Meanwhile, Islamic fundamentalism swept the Middle East. After the Iranian Revolution of 1979, terrorists began hailing not from Marxist groups, but from religious ones, such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Islamic Jihad. These terrorists espoused a warped vision of Islam that viewed the United States as the symbol and stronghold of satanic Western values. Inevitably, some of them made the U.S. their target. Unlike the violence of the 1960s and 70s, the recent attacks on the U.S. are not secular or Marxist. Unlike the nationalist terror of the IRA or the FLN, they're not designed to achieve a negotiated political settlement. Since this new terrorism doesn't play to world opinion can't act as a brake on it. Almost certainly, it will strike again.
You've been listening to David Greenberg, professor of history at Columbia University. Greenberg's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Nothing brings greater and more meaningful pride in one's country than knowledge of that country and its history. For this week's Site of the Week, Talking History, Cindy Workman tells you about a museum second to none in providing us with knowledge about the United States.
The Smithsonian National Museum of American History opened to the public in 1964 as the Museum of History and Technology and was the sixth Smithsonian building on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The name was changed in 1980 to better represent the basic mission of the museum. Inside, you will find everything from George Washington's field tent and the original Star-Spangled Banner to Ford's 1913 Model T and Dorothy's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. You'll find racing cars, locomotives, ancient coins, inaugural gowns of America's first ladies, musical instruments, farm machinery and furniture, and just about anything from the vast and fascinating mosaic of American life. The museum is open every day except Christmas, and admission is free.
And finally, on the subject of patriotism, turning to our segment, Coming Attractions, we call to your attention a touring exhibit of some of America's most famous original documents. The exhibit, American Originals, Treasures from the National Archives, is at the New York Public Library. It includes George Washington's inaugural address, actually delivered in New York City, and the deed of gift from France for the Statue of Liberty, erected in New York Harbor. It also hosts Abraham Lincoln's signed Emancipation Proclamation, Thomas Edison's patent application for an improvement in electric lamps, and a report from the Battle of Fort McHenry in Baltimore, which inspired the lyrics for the Star-Spangled Banner. Stacy Bredoff, senior curator at the National Archives, described the documents as a reminder of who we are, where we came from, and what we've accomplished over the last 200 years and what we have withstood. The exhibit closes at the New York Public Library on January 5th and travels to Chicago. Check with the National Archives in Washington, D.C. for the exact schedule of this touring exhibit, American Originals. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Hit first!